Lonergan's late writings. It's a 5,000 verbal court, and I welcome you. We all know each other, so I don't think we need to say too much to catch up with each other, but if you want to say something, let's just introduce ourselves. Jeff, you want to start?
I'm Jeff. I'm a doctoral student at St. Michael's College. I think that suffices.
I'm George. I'm in the THD program at Regis.
And I'm Mary Jo McDonald in the THD program at Regis.
I'm Robbie in the THM SCL program at Regis.
And I'm Greg Lozon, and I work at the Lonergan Research Institute.
Great. Good. So, the first part of what we're doing is what I've distributed to you, and then I have a longer lecture that I didn't distribute with, in which I'm commenting on the paper Insight Revisited. It's not a big deal whether you've read Insight Revisited in immediate preparation for this or not, but on the CCNet, no, it wasn't on CCNet, it was from CCNet that I found out who was in the course, and I sent an email recommending that you, if possible, either pick up a copy of Insight Revisited or pick up Second Collection and read Insight Revisited before today. But that's okay. I mean, we're going to be discussing Insight Revisited for the most part today. But that's all right. I think most of you probably didn't have time to. Anyway, here's what I'm starting out by. So the early part of what I want to say is in this presentation that I just handed out to you. One page of lecture and then two pages dividing up the material that we'll be reading in the course of this semester. In the first chapter of my book, Theology and the Dialectics of History, I suggested, if you remember, if you've read that, I mean, I think most of you have been in the course with me on that, that Lonergan's own intellectual development, particularly with respect to his position on the human subject. John, were you hoping to sit in?
No, actually, I'm teaching right next door.
Oh, all right, okay.
I may come over occasionally.
If I run into trouble, I'm over there. Okay. So that Lonergan's development could be traced through four stages. And this is, some of this is a bit arbitrary, but it's, at least it's one way of looking at his development. And basically, we will be focusing in on the third and fourth stages of that development in this course. The first stage reaches down through the publication of Insight. And there, his focus, obviously, is on knowing. It's a position on knowing. He's trying to work out that question, what am I doing when I'm knowing? Why is doing that knowing? And what do I know when I do that? Those are the three fundamental questions of that book. So he's definitely concerned with cognitional theory, epistemology, and metaphysics. With ethics and some comments about theology sort of tacked on at the end of the book, because he had to finish the book and go to Rome. He wanted to finish it before he went to Rome, so he added, he figured, well, I guess I better say something about ethics and something about theology, so he tacked on the last three chapters. But basically, it's cognitional theory, epistemology, and metaphysics. In the second stage, which is represented in Method and Theology, feelings, moral self-transcendence, a scale of values, judgments of value, decision, and conversion are given a prominence that they did not enjoy in Insight, at least explicitly. Very little is said about feelings in Insight. They're there, but not too much is said about them, whereas they become center stage in Method and Theology. It's in feelings that we apprehend possible values. That's a pretty important role in our lives. Feelings. So he has recognized a role to affect that was not recognized in Insight. And certainly if it was certainly not exploited. Moral self-transcendence. He's got a lot more on that in Method and Theology and in the things that he wrote around that time than he has in Insight. The scale of values is new in Method and Theology. There's a much more abbreviated scale of values that's in the 18th chapter of Insight, but it's nowhere near the expansion, the expansive potential of the scale of values, vital, social, cultural, personal, religious, that he mentions in Method and Theology. Judgments of value, decision, conversion. So much more prominent in Insight, in Method and Theology. So that second stage might be conveniently be assumed to extend through the publication in 1972 of Method and Theology. A third stage, and I think the more I've done in preparing for this class, the more I want to emphasize this, it emphasizes the increasing centrality of love. I call it third because it's only after Method and Theology. Love is very important in Method and Theology. It is. But it's only after Method and Theology that he links the emphasis on the gift of God's love, being in love in an unqualified fashion, with a fifth level of consciousness. That's only after Method and Theology. In Method and Theology, there's no mention of anything beyond four levels of consciousness. There are a few mentions of a fifth level in later material. And as you know, there's a debate in the literature, primarily between Michael Virton and myself on this, but I will continue to maintain that there is a fifth level and that it is not intentional consciousness, and I think that meets Virton's objections. It's given. It's not a response to any apprehended object, so it's not intentional. There are four levels of intentional consciousness: experiencing, understanding, judging, and deciding. But this gift, this consolation without a cause, means precisely that it's consolation that is just given. It's not a response to anything that I've apprehended. But it takes over more and more in Lonergan's thinking after Method and Theology, to the point where, as we'll see in the course of the semester, he changes the psychological analogy for the Trinity and begins it with love, not with understanding. So love is the primary thing. It's like, yes, Robbie.
Yeah, yes, Bob. I'm just wondering about this. I'm kind of thinking that, I think that, is this a natural right in historical mindedness where he speaks of the various principles that he has been speaking of? So he speaks of, okay, at the level of experience, understanding, and judgment, and so on. So there are principles of movement and rest that are operating
yep,
there.
That's natural.
But then he also says, well, there is a more comprehensive principle, being in love.
Yep.
So if you take that, isn't he there explicitly suggesting what you are calling the fifth level of consciousness there?
Yeah, but the natural right and historical mindedness is in this third stage.
Okay.
It's 1977. So it's one of the papers that we'll be reading this semester. So it is late. It's one of the late writings. So
how would you argue against that and say, well, that he's not referring to any distinct level of consciousness? Why?
In
Michael Virton's case, for instance, when he says...
I think that Michael, and when Michael was, he was criticizing something that I had written, and I don't think I had made it clear in what I wrote, that we have to distinguish between intentional and non-intentional. Mm-hmm. And Virton wanted to say there are only four levels. Now, there may be more, and I suspect that there might be more of a difference between the two of us on this, but I'd have to talk with him before I want to say that to anybody else. But I think, I know in one of our seminars, I asked him, and some of you may have been present, we were talking about this, and I said something about if consolation without a cause is consolation that is not a response to an apprehended object, then isn't it non-intentional? And he said yes. So if that's the case, that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the fifth level. It's not a constant thing, okay? And as St. Ignatius, when he's talking about consolation without a cause in the spiritual exercises, as he says in the exercises, it becomes intentional almost immediately because we start applying it to things in our daily life and we start making decisions on its basis and so on and so forth. And that's where Ignatius says you got to watch that step. But the consolation without a cause can only come from God, he says. But then after that, when it becomes intentional, we can get in the way of what it's trying to do, and that's why we have to watch where it's where we're going at that point. Does that make sense?
No.
But that's our response to love.
That's our response. That's right. Yeah. Our response is intentional.
Yeah.
But the gift, and this is the only thing I want to emphasize, is that the gift is simply given.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's given far more often than most people are able to acknowledge. You know, I mean, I think this is what Lonergan would say. I think that's what he would say. That it's actually quite frequent. And people just, they don't know. But God is operative in people's lives, and they don't know it. And that's why he says it's conscious, but not known.
When you say not know it, you mean not aware that this is a moment of consolation, or just
not aware that it has anything to do with God?
Oh, I see.
I think that's the thing. You know?
Yeah.
And so I think that's aware of the
experience, but just not name it.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, they're aware of it because it's conscious, mm-hmm. so they're aware, but they don't name it, and they don't. And there's no interpretation to it. And if somebody said, you know, God's operative in your life, I say, what? You know. So, and then they have this wacky notion of God, and they might say, I don't want anything to do with God, you know, because it's a different understanding of God that they're working with and all of that.
I just have a clarification here about this fifth level of consciousness. Are you referring to just God's love, or is it being in love?
It is being in love. Okay, that's what the experience is. I'm in love with. I mean, it's just in an unqualified fashion, and it's not a response to any. It's not opposed to that you're in love with a particular human being or whatever, but it's just, I don't know where this is coming from.
Caught up in something.
Yeah, you're caught up in something that's bigger than yourself, and you like it. It's a good feeling. You believe in it. You trust it, and that's what it is. And Lonergan is very explicit that is a created participation in God's own love from a theological point of view. That's what the gift is, looked at, viewed, understood theologically. We are participating in the very love that is God. But we don't know that when we experience it, you know, unless we've done a lot of theology and reflection on it. It just is. So, and it can become ever more pervasive as people meditate, focus, you know, do the things, and whether they're doing that within an explicitly religious context or not, if it's positional, what they're doing, this will develop in their lives, and this peace and serenity and so on will take over more and more and become more habitual. So, but all I'm wanting to emphasize is that is becomes more central even after. Now we'll be reading things around this, and we'll be finding different ways that he talks about it in this period after Method and Theology. But all I want to emphasize is that it's even more central. It's already in Method, but it's more central after. And it's only after, and I'm finding it particularly in the fact that he changed his analogy for the Trinity in those years. And he starts with agape rather than the intelligere, the understanding. He starts with the Father is now agape, uttering a judgment of value, which is the Word. And from agape and the judgment of value, there flows proceeding love. So we'll see that. We'll see. It's one of the things that we're going to be reading in Christology, the paper Christology today. So there's something that has happened here. He's taken over something that a lot of his students thought he'd never, you know, that they conceived of Lonergan as being so intellectualist that they were surprised when he started talking about love and feelings and conversion and so on and so forth. They just said, just the same guy that we've been saying.
Do we know if this was a result of his own experience?
Oh, I think it. I think everything he wrote was a result of his own experience, and he's reflecting on his own experience. Yeah. I don't think that he wrote anything that wasn't, that didn't come from reflection on his own experience. So he became Cardinal Martini's article. I think it's in the article. Have you seen it in the latest? Not the latest, but the second latest, second last theological studies. Cardinal Martini has the lead article is Bernard Lonergan in the Service of the Church, and it's the lecture that Cardinal Martini gave at the Gregorian University. Greg and I were there a year ago in November for the celebration of the centenary of Lonergan's birth. And he gave it in Italian, but it was translated into English and published in Theological Studies. But I think it's in that article itself that Martini's claiming that this is a mystical thing, that there was a mysticism in Lonergan that, you know, he would not ever go around boasting about. And so that he carried very lightly, but that he couldn't be talking this way without having some pretty intense prayer experiences.
Foundations.
Yeah. And then a fourth stage that I called in the book, I called it healing and creating, because it highlights movements not only from below, experiencing, understanding, judging, deciding, but also from above in consciousness. And that's only in 1975 in Healing and Creating in History, that paper. For the first time, he explicitly talks about, in addition to this movement from below, experiencing, understanding, judging, deciding, there is a movement from above. Now, we're using spatial metaphors here. We may want to find a different metaphor from it, but there's a reverse movement. That's the thing. That starts with being in love, and being in love changes your values. And because your horizon is changed, you see things. You understand things. You can make judgments that you couldn't make without that. And that changes, that can move all the way down into sensation, feeling, body. It can even heal the body. As we know, meditation can be healing if it permeates and reaches down into the neurons and the molecules, you know. So that's that movement from above. So those are the four stages that I see in his work. And I think he becomes more radical in this as he moves along in terms of emphasizing the centrality of love and of healing or of the movement from above. Consciousness, I think it becomes a more radical thing on his part. So the readings that we're going to be studying are concerned mainly with the third and the fourth stage, the stage in which love is central and where the movement from above is central. As Fred Crowe has said, we don't yet have worked out the details of that movement from above. Lonergan has painstakingly worked out the details of the movement from below. You know, he's starting with experience and then image and then question and then insight and concept and formulation and questions for reflection and judgment and so on. Well, he's got a lot of steps in there. But what are all the steps from above? How does love change a person's values? What happens? We know that it does, but how? What's going on? There's a lot of work that needs. There's another book, at least as long as Insight, that needs to be written about how it works that way.
Are you going
to
do that, Bob?
No, I can't do it. I don't think. I can just point to it. You know. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Okay?
I'm just wondering, Bob, how would you respond, let's say, if you had to someone like Levinas, who I think would place being in love at the base and then say, out of that, then you have all the other intentional levels.
I think I would say absolutely yes. And it's just a question of what metaphor we're using. That's why I think the spatial metaphor may very well have to be changed. Because what's most basic for Lonergan is love. That's what's most basic. And so from above and from below, I think we're going to have to jettison that language eventually. It doesn't work. But, I mean, it works as a... it works as a kind of a ladder to get you somewhere. But once you've gotten there, you can throw the ladder away, you know. And or otherwise, it gets in the way, and you become more concerned with the ladder than with moving on, you know. And so I think we do. I have no quarrels with, I don't think with the later Lonergan have any quarrels with the emphasis of Levinas. And I think that, as you said in your paper for my for the reading course that you did last semester, the focus on the other is central in Lonergan's late work. It is, there is that. So I think that the two studies that I've seen, I think there are two, there's one dissertation on Lonergan and Levinas, but Susan Saraceno, I think her name is, it's over in the Lonergan Research Institute. It's a short dissertation. It's not a detailed thing. But she's basically pointing to a complementarity rather than something radically diverse in what they're all about. Okay, so that outline of the four stages, as I say in the second paragraph here, it's sketchy, but it'll do for now. And it's basically to call attention to what we are focusing on here. What becomes prominent after method. No doubt further distinctions may be added in these stages. For example, I think the first stage, the cognitional stage, you can divide into three sub-stages if you want. Scholastic, the disengaging the Thomistic, what did Thomas really hold about knowledge? That's the first stage there, and that's the articles on verbum. So it's scholastic, the position that is in Thomas. Second, modern scientific, that's insight, right? Where what's really giving him the what he's hanging his hat on in insight is the way that insight functions in modern science. And then he takes off from there, and then he develops it out into other things. But he's come to grips with modern science. And then there's a hermeneutical phase, which is really after insight, where Lonergan's thought becomes more hermeneutical, and as he says in Insight Revisited, this happened when he moved to Rome, and there were students who had reading all these existential and phenomenological thinkers, and he said, I had to come to grips with them, and he said it was a really long, painful struggle to work through and appropriate what they were saying. But this is the period in which he read Husserl and Gadamer and so on, and it became and so his theory of meaning is developed. The theory of meaning in method and theology is far more sophisticated and extensive than the theory of meaning in method and theology, and so that's all part of the hermeneutical stage there. So I think you could subdivide the cognitional phase. So, anyway, it is with what I'm here calling the third and fourth stages that we will be primarily concerned in this course, the stage in which love becomes prominent, more prominent even than understanding. Not that he's jettisoning understanding. He would never do that. And the stage in which love's movement is highlighted as inverse to that movement that seeks correct understanding. Not that it's opposed to it, but it's moving in another way. It's an influence in another way. Now, I don't think that any of the subsequent stages represents an about-face, a complete repudiation of the principal achievements of the earlier phases. He certainly would never deny what he said about insight and judgment in method and theology. He does add a new notion of decision in method that is different from the one that he gives in insight, but I've argued that the two are complementary rather than opposed, and I will stand on that, and I'm willing to, we can get into that discussion as the course goes along. Advance, there is an advance. Sometimes he's correcting earlier views, but not a dialectical reversal of the major affirmations of what preceded. So it's not like he's that he all of a sudden stood up and said, well, insight's completely wrong, forget that book, throw it out, I'm starting all over. This word kehre, K-E-H-R-E, means turn. And they speak of a kehre in Heidegger's thought, from thought to being. And that's what I'm using here, drawing on your paper from the last semester. If there is this kind of turnabout in Lonergan's intellectual development, and I think there is, I don't think it entails a repudiation of what went before. It's basically turning from, again, to use the spatial metaphor, turning from the way upward to the way downward. It affects everything, but it doesn't overturn anything achieved in the basic positions of the earlier work. It pushes these basic positions to their radical conclusions. It raises the question of their ultimate conditions of possibility, but it does not go back on them in the least. So, that's at least how I would see it. Lonergan always, or almost always at least, tells you when he's changed his mind. So, he's not reluctant to say, I don't think I was right on that. And so he will tell you. So I don't think we need to interpret these differences as his jettisoning everything that went before, because if he intended to say that, I think he would have said it. But I don't think he intended it. Obviously he doesn't. His whole notion of self-transcendence, well, intellectual self-transcendence, is what insight is all about. It's just that there's also moral self-transcendence and religious self-transcendence and affective self-transcendence, and he didn't talk much about those in insight. So, and they now become more important in the whole picture, even than intellectual self-transcendence. All right, another way of coming at these. More recently, I have considered the period that we're going to be studying as containing three characteristics. First, Lonergan becomes a more radical thinker. He begins to see the implications of what he's been about. So there is this. A couple of examples of it will show up in Dialectic of Authority and in Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, two of the papers that we'll be reading here. Dialectic of Authority. There is no authority without authenticity. That's a very radical statement. There might be power, but there's no authority. Authority is legitimate power. Only authenticity confers legitimacy. Without authenticity, there's no authority, just power. That's a radical statement. The earlier Lonergan, who was a conservative Catholic in many ways, would not have said that. Okay, I don't think he would have gone that far, but he's seeing this. He still remained a conservative Catholic when it came to the Trinity and Christ and all of that sort of thing, but he's seeing this as the implication of what I've been talking about. And then in Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, what basically is natural law? Be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. That's what it is. Nothing else. So that, again, a radical drawing out of the implications of what he's been saying.
Yeah. Did he say that authority is given in that paper? I think I remember him saying authority is given. Somebody can't just take authority or assume authority. It's given.
Oh, it's given by the community.
Yeah. So does that mean that authenticity is recognized?
Yeah.
And then,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, and I should have included that, but I don't have the paper with me, but it's in there that it arises out of the community. Mm-hmm. Power can be taken.
Yeah.
Authority is given. Another way of characterizing this period is from a musical analogy, and I learned by listening to a couple of people a number of years ago at Boston College. People who are familiar with the work of Beethoven have commented that in his late quartets, which are the last things I believe that he wrote, it all comes together, all of Beethoven's characteristic ways of composing, but in a whole new register, with a whole new sophistication and subtlety and nuance. And people have said, I'm not the first one to say this, in fact I've learned it from others, these things, some of these things at least that we'll be reading this semester, that's like that with Lonergan. Like all of these themes that he's been talking about all these years is still there, but they're in a new register, in a new key, with a new sophistication, a new subtlety, a new nuance. All of the previous emphases and discoveries now take form in a new register, and so on, with a new sophistication, a new subtlety of rhetorical expression, new nuances, glimpsed in different ways in different papers. And I forget what the third characteristic was. I didn't put it down here. Oh, I think it's the thing about love. It must have been that. Anyway, so the second last paragraph on this page. The writings that we'll be reading, there are 30 of them. With the exception of one, Insight Revisited, which I'll comment on today, they can be found in two books, a third collection, and Philosophical and Theological Papers, 1965 to 1980, volume 17 of the collected works of Bernard Lonergan. So you should all have those two books. And if you don't have them, you can purchase them. Well, you can probably get them at Crooks, but you can also get them at the Lonergan Research Institute. And our prices over there are $15 for a third collection and $32.95 for the... I don't know if Crooks has volume 17. In fact, Crooks does have a third collection because they bought some copies of it from us. Okay, so Insight Revisited was published in a second collection and is reproduced for you here, this as a single item, the first one that we'll investigate. Why am I starting with that? Well, first of all, it was written in this period. It was after Method. So it was written in 1972. His copyright is 1972. He delivered it in April of 1973. And it will give us some indication of just where his mind was at the beginning of this period that we're investigating. It will tell us where he changed his mind from insight, what new influences, at least some of them, he would acknowledge, what new formulations he might be entertaining. Anyway, the 30 items are on page 2 that we'll be studying. That's page 2 of what I gave you. They're all listed there with the year. It's the next page of this. The year, in terms of the year in which, as far as I can tell, they were written. Some of them, it's not absolutely certain what year they were written, but I did the best that I could to order them by the year in which they were written. And you'll notice when it's interesting to just see this as you get towards the bottom of the page as he's diminishing himself and weakening. It's less and less that's coming out. You know, in 1982, the last thing, probably the last thing that he wrote. And then he died just 2 years after that. And then the third page, I'm just suggesting the schedule for the semester for the sake of putting some order into this array. And I'm suggesting that we read these papers chronologically. This is the first time that I've taught this course, so I may find out in the course of the semester that I should have rearranged them by theme, but we'll try it chronologically and try to see if we can follow a development. I always like to read an author chronologically anyway. So, and then the last, greater order can be introduced if we realize, if you look back to page 2 there, in 1972, the last three of those, Philosophy of God, the Functional Specialty Systematics, and then Philosophy of God and the Functional Specialty Systematics, well, those are three lectures in one set, so they belong together, so we'll study those together, and that's basically what I'm thinking of for next week. And then the next four from 1973 were all given together at Trinity College in November of 1973, so we'll do all those four together, because they were given one night after another. I went to them. I was here in the fall, and I was there for those four lectures. And then there's one other set. Oh, 1976, down to 1976, the first three, Religious Experience, Religious Knowledge, and the Ongoing Genesis of Methods, were all part of one series of lectures at Queen's College in Kingston. So that's another set that we'll study together. So this page 3 will give you the suggested breakdown. Now, we'll have to see how things go in terms of time and so on, and we may decide as time goes by that one or other of these is not that important and we're a little bit behind, so we might skip one of them or touch on it very lightly or whatever. But this is, at least will give us some kind of a way to start. So after today, you will need those two books, A Third Collection and Volume 17, The Philosophical and Theological Papers, 1965 to 1980. Okay? All right, so let me begin by talking about Insight Revisited. Follow along here. I'll be pointing to things on different pages. So in this paper, in Insight Revisited, Lonergan's providing us with a basic overview of what I'm calling the first stage in his intellectual development. But it's an overview that he's giving us after he's completed at least the second stage. So he's going back from a later stage and going back and looking at his work as a young man, as it were, and saying, well, and he's basically saying, you know, I would still hold this, and I would still hold this, but I'd make some changes here, and I think that I really goofed up on this. He particularly says that with regard to chapter 19 of Insight. Not that he would deny the position that he presents there, but he says it comes in out of left field. Because I've been talking about experience all along, cognitional experience, moral experience. Then I start talking about God, but I don't say anything about religious experience. And so he said the context for making any sense out of God, I ignored. And so he's making up for that in his later work. Anyway, that's the kind of thing that he's doing. So from a later position, 15 years later, after the publication of Insight, and after he's developed significantly in several ways, he's looking back at that book. So it gives us a good background for the further stages that we will be studying in the remainder of the course. Date-wise, the copy on the autograph of the paper, we have it in the Institute, and he has a copyright there of 1972, so that's probably when he wrote it. But it was actually delivered for the first time at the Jesuit Philosophical Association meeting on April 3rd, 1973. Okay, he begins the paper. So the first part of the paper would be from the first couple of pages, actually, 263 and 264. He gives a background account of the factors. Well, excuse me, it's more than that. It's down to... down to 268, he's giving a background account of the factors that influenced the writing of Insight, down to 268. So he starts with his own philosophical studies at Heathrop, and he was a young man. He was born in 04, so, and he went to Heathrop in 26, so he was 22 years old when he started his philosophical studies, and he was there from 26 to 29. Well, he was presented with a philosophy that he hated. He respected his teachers. He said they were very honest in their presentation of their wares, but he couldn't stand the philosophy. And he would later characterize it as conceptualist and essentialist rather than intellectualist and existentialist. So he was reacting against a static conceptualism and essentialism in this philosophy that he was presented. This emphasis on universal concepts and the unchanging nature of conceptual systems, and particularly of the conceptual system that these professors and textbooks were putting forth. So he reacted very strongly against the philosophy that he was being taught. And he preferred, he says, to consider himself a nominalist rather than giving universal concepts this significance that they were playing in this philosophy that he was being taught. Now, by nominalism, he means, and I've got this down here with just the basic understanding of nominalism. Nominalism is, I should have perhaps duplicated this entire lecture for you instead of just the first part. Nominalism is a philosophical position that basically will say that all universal or abstract terms are necessities of thought. conveniences of language. They exist as names only and have no general realities corresponding to them. Everything is particular and individual, and there are so generalizations, universalizations, are all things that we have to do in order to get some kind of control over our experience. But he said, I would much have preferred to hold that than to hold this position of the centrality of universal concepts. So he was reacting pretty strongly. He was into and close to a kind of empiricism that all connectedness in thinking is purely subjective, and that knowledge is that really all we know are the particularities that we experience. He would not have been just a sensist as a Jesuit and a spiritual person. He would have said there's also spiritual particularities and not just sense particularities. But particularities, that's it. Now, he wrote 5 papers during these years, and the first two, they'll be coming out in volume 20 of the collected works, which is the second next volume that will be appearing, and we're working on these now. The first two papers are two of the hardest things that he ever wrote. But he's struggling at this time. One of them is called The Form of Mathematical Inference, and the other one is called The Syllogism. But what he's basically doing is expressing his consternation with the philosophy that he's being taught and struggling to find something to replace it. He's struggling, and you can see it in the very first paper, he's struggling to articulate what later would become insight into image. The importance of images is very clear in that very first paper, the very first thing that we have from his pen. The importance of images that he's dealing now with mathematics, mathematical knowledge. But mathematical knowledge is not conveyed by formalization in universal concepts. It's conveyed through images, diagrams, that he doesn't have the language for this yet, but what it will come to is that provide the phantasm for insight. So it's the importance of the diagram. He's not yet at insight, but he's definitely at the diagram. We learn through images. Okay. If it's going to be really learning that stays with us, but he's struggling to articulate that. He's not quite there yet. And this is what was lacking from his philosophical training at that time. And I think with many of the great philosophers, so much of their development is influenced by their realization of what was lacking in the philosophy they were taught. So this is how he started out. And for Lonergan, what was lacking was this insight into image understanding. Understanding was lacking. Because everything was conceptual system. The links were between concepts, rather than links to be discovered out of experience and image. His great discovery during these years was Newman, John Henry Newman, Grammar of Assent. And he said that he read portions of Newman 4, 5, 6 times, portions of that book. And he says on page 263 of Insight Revisited that Newman's illiterate sense became my reflective act of understanding. Well, what Newman is doing in the Grammar of Assent is he's trying to express concretely how do we reach convictions. And it's not through syllogistic reasoning, but it's rather through the accumulation of probabilities, not in the statistical sense, but that we're getting ever closer to something that we can say yes to. And that's what would later become in Insight Lonergan's reflective act of understanding, grounding of virtually unconditioned. So, takes that from Newman. But they're still missing, even, and that his third paper in those 5 years is on Newman, and it's the, but definitely the clearest of the five things that he wrote. The other two were very short, and but they're still missing a notion of this direct understanding of insight that mediates between sensory and imaginative experience on the one hand and concepts on the other hand. In between is insight, grounded in concepts. Okay. It's not there yet. So he says something about that on page 263. Page 264, in the early 1930s, while he was teaching at Loyola College in Montreal, there were several important discoveries. He read Christopher Dawson's The Age of the Gods, he said, and that introduced me to the anthropological notion of culture, and so began the correction of my hitherto normative or classicist notion of culture. So cultures, the anthropological notion of culture, there are as many cultures as there are different sets of meanings and values governing the way people live. And no culture is normative. That's his clear position later in life. But as most Catholics trained in these years, he originally was taught a very normative and classicist notion of culture. That this culture that comes from Greece and Rome is normative, and everything else is, you know, in the shadow. And then there was another book, J.A. Stewart's book, Plato's Doctrine of Ideas, and I've looked at that book myself. But it was a great release for him, because he found out that Plato's ideas were not these universal concepts, but rather they were answers to questions. So he said, this book contained much that later I was to work out for myself in a somewhat different context, but at that time when I read it, it was a great release. Why was it a great release? Because he discovered in reading Stewart that his nominalism, that, you know, concepts are simply subjective necessities that help us deal with the complexity of the particular. His nominalism had been in opposition not to intelligence or understanding, but to the central role ascribed to universal concepts. He discovered that what had been missing from his philosophical training was understanding, the act of understanding. So the distinction of understanding and concept, and he makes it in these early years, the early 1930s. Understanding is one thing. Concept is something else. Understanding is an act in which I grasp an intelligibility, and then I may still be struggling to formulate that. The formulation is put in conceptual terms. But I've already got a handle. You've got a handle on something. That's insight. That's understanding. Okay, so then he began reading Plato's early dialogues, Augustine's early dialogues, and so on. Notice there's no influence of Thomas Aquinas yet. Thomas is barely mentioned in these papers from Heathrow. And the only thing that's mentioned in the papers from Heathrow of Thomas is what Thomas called the vis cogitativa, the cogitative sense, cogitative power, which is basically something that in Thomas is linking sensation and intellection. So notice again, there's that whole thing about insight linking between sensation and concept, but he's still just approaching that. He's not there yet. But he finds in Augustine this concern with understanding, and not with universal concepts, but with understanding. And then he says, I began, and this is very interesting to us at the Lonergan Research Institute, I began a long period of trying to write an intelligible account of my convictions. So this is in the early 1930s. Why? The reason that I'm saying this is interesting is that we have in the archives at the Lonergan Research Institute these assorted pages of what was obviously a very long document. And Fred Crow and I both think these are pages out of what he's talking about here. This intelligible, trying to write an intelligible account of my convictions. But we don't have the full document. He used these pages later on He turned them over and wrote on the back of them. That's why he kept them. So we have, it's like if you had page 4 and page 8 of these nodes, well, that's what I started out with, but then I used page 4 to write something on, and I used page 8 to write something on, and I threw the others out. Well, that's basically what he seems to have done with this account of his convictions in the 1930s. But anyway, I think that's what we have over there. And it's interesting to read, but there's no way we can possibly string it all together. So are you following me up to this point in terms of what's happening here? You've got this, you've got a sense already, something's wrong with this philosophy, and it's going to become image, insight, concept. But he's not there yet. But he's getting there, and he's moving towards it. So we have something emerging. Understanding mediating between presentations and concepts. That's what's emerging. But he's still not clear on that. And then we have something like Newman's illative assent leading to assent. So we've got something like experiencing, understanding, and judgment. It's actually... Let me go through one more period. You can close it. I'll go through one more paragraph of what I've got here, and then we can take our break. So you've got something like experiencing, understanding, and judging emerging. So from the struggles in Heathrop, you've got something, the elemental potential for image, insight, concept, but it's not that clear yet. And then from his reading of Newman, you've got reflective understanding and judgment. That's clearer. He's clearer on that than he is on insight, image, insight, concept. And then judgment, and this is where he becomes a Thomist, is in Rome, where he gets into Thomas. The elements of assent or judgment became much clearer to him, even than they were from reading Newman, when he was studying theology in Rome. And he talks on page 265. If we could look at page 265 of the notes. I was sent to Rome for theology, and there I was subject to two important influences. One was from an Athenian, Stephanos Stephanou, who had entered the Jesuit Sicilian province and had been sent to Louvain to study philosophy at a time when Joseph Maréchal, who was one of the leading people in the school that's become known as Transcendental Thomism, a person that tried to take Kant seriously rather than saying, you know, let's just go back before Kant and take a good look at things. You know. So Maréchal was teaching psychology to the Jesuit students, and the other professors were teaching Maréchal. So in other words, Maréchal was the central figure at Louvain. Stephanou and I used to prepare our exams together. Our aim was clarity and rigor, an aim all the more easily obtained the less the theses really meant. But it was, he said, it was through this man, Stephanou, by some process of osmosis, rather than struggling with the five great volumes, cahiers, of Maréchal. Maréchal's five volumes were called Le Point de Départ de la Métaphysique, the point of departure for metaphysics. So he never read those in their entirety, but rather through, by a process of osmosis, through talking with this man, I learned to speak of human knowledge as not intuitive but discursive, with the decisive component in judgment. So human knowledge is not intuitive in the sense, intuitive now, not in the sense where intuition sometimes means insight, but rather it's not intuitive in the sense that knowing is not taking a look. Intuition in that sense of Anschauung in German.
Naive realism.
Yeah, it's not intuitive in that sense, but it's discursive. We get to judgment by thinking and talking, and it's only in judgment and only in correct judgment that we know, and only in judgments that we know are correct, that we know that we know. So it's a movement towards judgment. Human knowing is a movement towards judgment, and he came to see that at this time. Osmosis from Marischal. This is obviously Marischal's own position. This view was confirmed by my familiarity with Augustine's key notion, veritas, truth. And the whole was rounded out, I'm going to try to explain this if I can, briefly, by Bernard Leeming's course on the incarnate word, which convinced me that there could not be a hypostatic union in the incarnate word, okay, without a real distinction between essence and existence. Okay, what does that mean? Okay, but this is important because he's becoming a Thomist here. Okay, so he's seeing if you assert the real distinction between essence and existence, which the Swarisians that governed the philosophy that he was being taught at Heathrow did not affirm. Okay, but if you do affirm it, then you're loosening up again the importance given to essence, the concept, and you're putting an emphasis on existence. And you're grasping, you're getting into a way of being able to talk about theologically creaturely reality, because our essence is not to exist. So we have our existence from God, creation, and so on. Okay, but what does he mean when he says this, that if there could not be a hypostatic union without a real distinction between essence and existence? I can't resist. I hope you don't get angry at me for doing this, but I'm going to put a Latin. This is the very first item in the archive across the street. The very first item in the archive that was written by Longinus himself, and it's a very short Latin, and I think it's the expression of this insight that he can. So I'm just going to put it up here. Existentia non est perfectio quod sed quo. I assure you, I will translate this in a moment. One day, Christus sine existencia humana est verus homo. Existencia verbi. Okay. So, literally translated, it means this. Existence is not a perfection that, but a perfection by which. So it's something by which we are. Okay, it's not what we are, but it's something by which we are. So it's not a perfection that we are. This is not so much the case for God, of course, but for us. It's not something that we are, but something by which we are. That's the meaning of the first part of that. So from there we can... Unde means whence, therefore. Christ, without a human existence, without a human act of existence, is a true human being, verus homo. He is a true human being by reason of essence, by having the human essence. But he exists with the existence of the divine word. So his existence is the existence of the divine word.
Sorry, he's a really human being.
By reason of essence. In other words, he has a human nature. So by human nature, he's a real human being. But he exists with the existence of the divine word. So the essay, the act of existence of the incarnate word, is the act of existence of the divine word. But he's a true human being by reason of having a human nature, as well as the divine nature, of course. So what Lonergan is saying is that if you don't grant the real distinction of essence and existence, you can't explain the incarnate word. Because the incarnate word's existence is one thing, his human essence or his human nature is something else. So, but anyway, it was through this course, and through, with this kind of an emphasis that comes out of Thomas's Christology, that Lonergan became a Thomist. Before that, he was not particularly enamored of Aquinas. So does that make sense? Am I making some sense here?
So it is in the realm of existence that it's possible to understand the hypostatic union.
Without the distinction of existence and essence, you can't understand it. Because the word, the incarnate word exists by reason of the divine act of existence, which is his, which is the act of existence of the divine word. And he is a human being by reason of human nature, which is a question of essence.
So you, if you stay in a formulation of essence, you will never understand the hypostatic union.
See, and Lonergan will say, he says elsewhere that between Aquinas and 20th century theology, that most Catholic theologians didn't really understand the Trinity or the Incarnation. Because they were caught in this closed conceptual system that didn't understand the distinction of essence and existence. They didn't, the whole Swarisian tradition. But even earlier, with Scotus and so on, they overlooked insight into image grounding concept. And without insight grounding concept, there is no analogy for the word proceeding from the Father's understanding. So if your analogy is understanding, if the Father is understanding speaking a word, well, if you don't have any sense of what it means that we speak words out of our understanding, then you have no analogy for understanding the procession of the Word in the Trinity. So there's a whole 7 centuries of theology and philosophy that he's reacting against, ultimately. In his Tertianship, he doesn't say it in here, but in his Tertianship, he came to the conclusion that the whole of Catholic philosophy and theology had to be rewritten. And that's what he set out. He set out to do as much of that as he could. So, a rather big task. You know. That was what he saw as his vocation. Okay, let's break and we can come back. So let me just say, wait, is there anything else here? No, there isn't much more. So in a germinal form by 1937 or 1938, we have the bare outlines of what would become experience, understanding, judgment. But it isn't filled out yet. We can come back and we'll finish this. Let's take about a 10-minute break. Okay.